Babe. Hi, everybody. So glad to be with you today. For those of you who've been with us on previous Fridays in September and October, welcome back. If you're new, joining us for the first time, thank you. We're really excited that you're here with us today. As Abe said, we're going to move through some polls just so we can find out a little bit more about our audience, like where you're from, what's your professional background, and the kind of years of experience in this topic. That'll help us as we do future webinars and on this topic. Here we are. We made it to webinar three. This is the last webinar in our series of the Redevelopment Academy. So just a little bit about why my office is sponsoring these webinars. Here at EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, we primarily provide grants to communities to help them assess and clean up sites. We also provide clarifications of liability under CERCLA. But in the land revitalization part of our program, we really focus on how to help communities reuse properties that were contaminated or were perceived to be contaminated or may even have contamination left in place. And we do that while trying to help them achieve environmental benefits, equitable development, and economic benefits as well. So we've been for years working with communities to help them in this. We do have a lot of publications that are out. What you're seeing here are just some of the recent ones, and they're also in the URL box just to the right of your screen. So please take a look at these resources and use them. And let us know if you have questions. So as I said, we're on our third webinar. And just a reminder kind of what we wanted to share from the series and what we hope that you'll get out of it. We started in September talking about how developers perceive and deal with contaminated sites when planning redevelopment. And then last month, we talked about the role of the market. We talked about what to do when there is no market or in a weak market situation. And today, we're going to talk about financing and funding and how to factor those into the financial bottom line. How do you deal with the site when there are developers involved, and how does that affect the other players involved with the site? So we're going to be talking about all those things. We had held this series internally and with our state and tribal partners last year, and then we were able to convert what we learned from that experience to be able to offer this to our wide audience, open it up to community members this year. So we also have a workshop coming up. You'll hear us mention this a few times at the National Brownfields Conference. It's on December 10th. It's a half day. And we're going to be going through that workshop where you'll be able to apply all the concepts through a real estate scenario. You get to basically be the developer and pitch project ideas to the site owner and local government. We are going to be going through, and as Abe said, having an opportunity to answer questions. So please, I invite you all to use the Q&A box so that we can have lots of great questions for our presenters. And here's our slide for the conference. It's coming up really soon, next month. And please note this, brownfields2019.org. I hope that you can all join us there. And it's on the pre-conference day, December 12th, when we'll have our workshop. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to our instructors. And they're going to be introduced by Michael Taylor from the firm Vita Nova. Vita Nova is a redevelopment consultant firm. They've done a lot of land revitalization projects across the country, dealing especially with brownfield sites. And their work with EPA specifically has helped communities identify really feasible reuse opportunities and worked with them to move sites into redevelopment. So they bring a lot of expertise to this topic, and that's why we have them with us today. So I'm going to turn it over to Mike Taylor. to take it from here.
Great. Thank you, Amy. So this is the third and last webinar. Elaine Richardson helped us with the last webinar and this one. She was actually the original author of this program, and that comes from her experience working with us in sites across the country, figuring out how to get development to occur in first, second, and third and fourth tier communities. And so she's going to open up the pro forma a little bit and show you how developers make these sites work. Tony Bielecki joined us a few years ago. Tony had a long career in economic development, most of which was spent in the city of New Haven. If you haven't been to the city of New Haven in the last 5-10 years or so, it's really gone through a transformation to some degree due to his efforts working on downtown, brownfield sites, all kinds of projects around the city. So he's going to bring a lot of experience to this, showing you how to get it done on tough sites. And then I'll come back and talk a little bit more. Go ahead to the next slide. I'll come back and talk a little bit more. We've got some special guests for you guys today, two developers who are out there getting it done. They're going to open up their secret toolbox for you and show you how they do it. Very exciting stuff, and we're in a great time in the market for them to be talking to you. So in the second hour, we'll be hearing from them, but for now, Elaine and Tony will be talking to you about the fundamentals of real estate, evaluating redevelopment potential. We've got a site that we are going to talk you through, and then looking at financial feasibility. So with that, Elaine?
Thank you, Mike, and welcome to everyone who's joining us today. The goals for today are to help each of you understand the basics of real estate finance. And in doing so, you'll have a better appreciation for how environmental cleanup and liability affects decision-making and costs. And hopefully, this will better prepare you for interactions and negotiations with the real estate development community. We hope that through this webinar and the topics we've covered earlier in earlier webinars, you will appreciate the positive opportunity that contaminated properties present for economic development and how redevelopment of these sites can spur broader community revitalization. Throughout this course, you'll hear a number of terms that you may be familiar with and some terms that may also be new to you. I can focus on three of those terms that are particularly important to our discussion today. Back of the envelope refers to a simple mathematical formula that developers run in the early stages of the project to determine if a potential development is feasible. This is not a complex or comprehensive financial analysis, but rather a quick calculation done to decide whether to invest the time and money to further evaluate the site. A sources and uses schedule is a financial chart that shows the sources of funding identified for a project and the expected uses of those funds. This schedule is especially important when certain types of funding, such as grants, come with restrictions on how those funds can be used. And leverage is the use of borrowed money to increase the return on investment. And Tony will explain how leverage is used on a deal later on in this webinar. There are a few reasons why it's important for you to understand real estate finance. First, it's helpful for you to understand how developers make money so that you have realistic expectations about what can and cannot be accomplished in a given market. This understanding will also help you recognize a good proposal and when a developer might be selling you a bill of goods. understanding sources and uses will help you write stronger grant applications and find more grant opportunities that you may not have thought of previously. We're also hopeful that this course will help you leverage other projects within your communities and result in more effective revitalization programs. So let's start by reviewing the costs that developers incur while completing a development. There are property costs, which include much more than just a purchase price. Developers must pay taxes and utility bills and other holding costs during planning and construction. For larger multi-year developments, this poses a risk that tax structures and other rates estimated in the original pro forma can change during the construction process. For brownfield projects, environmental conditions can affect a project pro forma in a number of ways. The hard costs of remediation must be estimated up front, but the costs of unknown contamination, liability risks, and regulatory delays that result in increased holding costs or loss of a tenant are much harder for a developer to estimate. And all of these costs have the potential to derail a project. Developers expect to invest significant dollars into site preparation, building construction, and even most on-site infrastructure costs. However, not all developments can absorb the costs of off-site infrastructure improvements, such as extending a water or a sewer line, or bringing in natural gas and power. All of these costs go into a project pro forma, which determines the financial feasibility of a project. So some key things that you should look for when talking to a developer about a project include how much or in what way are they personally investing in the project. That's their skin in the game, and that's when you know they're serious. Do they have or are they counting on specific deals with lenders, regulators, or other stakeholders in order to get the development done? And how realistic are those deals? How time critical is their development? If there are significant delays, will the development fail? Are their expectations that they've put into their pro forma reasonable? That'll help you evaluate whether or not a proposal you're looking at is actually viable. You may remember this slide from our first webinar, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but this is to remind you that not all real estate markets are the same. And because of that, project financing is different depending on which market a property is located in. First-tier markets in large cities attract more lenders and investors, garner higher lease rates and sale rates, and result in higher value developments. So these projects can absorb more environmental and infrastructure costs than projects in other markets. Projects in second, third, and fourth tier markets, such as smaller cities and rural communities, are much more challenging. End users are harder to come by, and lease and sales rates are lower. And interest rates may be higher because the projects are riskier. These projects often require public assistance to help cover environmental infrastructure and other costs to make the project viable. There are different forms of financing used in each stage of a real estate development. In the pre-development stage, the developer often puts up their own money to cover the costs of planning, design, and even potentially site acquisition. Grants and tax credits may be used to cover due diligence costs, such as environmental assessments, and in-kind contributions, such as market studies, can be provided by economic development agencies. Construction costs are typically covered by a variety of loans, both public and bank financed. Public funding may be used to cover infrastructure costs, especially if off-site infrastructure improvements are necessary to meet capacity needs. And grants and incentives can also be used to cover environmental remediation and other construction-related tasks. Once construction is complete, developers tend to convert loans to permanent financing mechanisms, such as mortgages. Construction phase loans come at a premium, as there is no asset to guarantee the loan. So moving to a long-term mortgage is much more cost-effective once the development is built. Tax increment financing, commonly referred to as a TIF, is a public financing method that is sometimes used as a subsidy for redevelopment, infrastructure, and other community improvements. While the structure varies by the agreement with the community, generally financing is based upon and paid for by the expected incremental increase in property tax revenues once the development is built. These TIFs are structured over an extended period of time, such as 20 years. Long-term financing of operations and management of the property are typically paid for by tenant rents, but they can also be supported by economic development incentives, such as workforce tax credits and other public financing. We've talked about the stages of financing. Now I want to spend a minute talking about the sources of financing. There are essentially three sources: the private sector, the public sector, and nonprofits. Private sector investors include traditional lenders such as banks. It also includes private sector institutional lending such as insurance companies, pension funds, and publicly traded funding through real estate investment trusts and commercial mortgage-backed securities. Public sector financing includes tax increment financing that we just talked about, as well as economic development incentives and public sector direct investments such as public infrastructure improvements and grants. Nonprofits are potential funding sources that aren't often talked about. Depending on the property and the redevelopment plan, foundations and nonprofit institutions such as universities may very well invest in a redevelopment. This is especially true in redevelopments that include open space and recreational components. In our last webinar, we discussed the three types of analyses that are used to predict the financial feasibility of a project. If you joined us, hopefully you remember a little bit about the opportunities and constraints analysis, the market analysis, and the feasibility analysis. Today we'd like to walk you through the process of determining financial feasibility by exploring the case of one industrial site located in the Midwest. This property was taken through tax foreclosure and was under the ownership of the city. Fortunately, the city had performed a phase one and phase two on the property, and it performed all appropriate inquiry prior to taking ownership, ensuring that the city was eligible for additional public funding. The city's goal was to create a shovel-ready project that could be put out to the development market through a request for proposal process in order to facilitate redevelopment, thereby creating jobs and increasing tax revenues. The opportunities and constraints analysis on the property showed that this property had a lot going for it. It was 265 acres, which should allow for significant development. The access was excellent, with rail service and good local roads. The location was good. It was close to a major shipping port and three commercial airports. And the site was located in a community reinvestment area, which provided economic development incentives, including job creation tax credits. So at first blush, the opportunity looked excellent, but the site was not without its challenges. Of the 265 acres, only 145 of them were developable. It's still a large site, but there were significant wetland and floodplain restrictions on a large area. The site was located in a third-tier market, with limited demand. So a large site like this is a real challenge to fill. The foundations from the former manufacturing building remained on site. While these do not present an environmental challenge, they do present an engineering challenge. Developers would incur costs to either remove and dispose of tons of concrete debris or need to design the redevelopment to place building footings or parking lots around the foundations. The most significant strain on the site was the lack of modern infrastructure. In order to achieve the highest and best development scenario, over 1.5 miles of new roadways, 1 mile of sanitary sewer lines, 1.5 miles of public water lines, and 2 miles of stormwater lines were needed throughout the interior of the site. In addition, the site was contaminated. The environmental conditions were actually very manageable. On-site soils were impacted with lead and arsenic, which allowed for the remediation and redevelopment to be integrated. The remediation plan called for impacted soils located within utility corridors or encountered during redevelopment to be either relocated on-site under new roads and parking lots, or the contaminated soils would be excavated and disposed of off-site. Other impacted areas would be capped underneath parking lots, building foundations and roadways, and managed under a long-term soil management program. Deed restrictions would be placed on the property to ensure long-term controls remained in place. A market analysis looked at population trends, demographics, labor statistics, industry clusters, and commercial lease and sale rates. And hopefully those of you who joined us for the marketing webinar last month recognize what goes into a market analysis. This analysis found that while the property is located in a third-tier market, the overall market was doing well, and there was interest in the region for certain industrial and commercial uses. The analysis also determined that due to the size of the site, it was best developed as a multi-user industrial park in a phased approach to respond to demand. The market analysis identified demand for three types of industrial uses. However, as you'll see over the next three slides, the financial implications of these uses varied a little bit. A strong market for multi-tenant warehouses existed. Single users in this market usually require something in the range of 50,000 square feet, and a multi-tenant development might be up to 500,000 square feet. The cost of building these metal-type warehouse buildings average $38 to $42 a square foot in this market. And the lease rates running in the market were about $3 a square foot. Manufacturing accounted for 17% of the state's gross domestic product, and there continued to be demand for new modern manufacturing buildings. Like the warehouse market, single users were looking for something in the range of 50,000 square feet, and a multi-tenant industrial park could be as large as 500,000 square feet. The lease rates were running a little higher for these types of buildings, at about $5 a square feet. Industrial flex space is a little different. The market showed that most of these spaces are owner-occupied, but there was a small demand for rental space. These types of buildings are typically used by building trades, service contractors, and smaller industrial users. You might see plumbers, HVAC contractors, landscapers using these types of buildings. The single users in this market wanted something a little bit smaller, around 40,000 square feet. So being able to fill 500,000 square feet to fill the site could be tough with this type of building. Construction costs were generally in that $40 a square foot range, but also ran as high as $80 a square foot, depending on the amenities such as mezzanine office space or specialty industrial fixtures that the tenant required. Lease rates were comparable to manufacturing in that they ran about $5 a square foot. So as I said earlier, the city wanted to provide the market with a shovel-ready, economically feasible development opportunity. So they ran a back-of-the-envelope spreadsheet. These numbers represent an overview of what the development would cost, including remediation, infrastructure, construction costs, soft costs such as design, permitting, and legal work, and carrying costs such as taxes and interest on construction loans. The back of the envelope also projects the value of the project at completion based upon the projected operating income, and that's where those lease rates play an important role. So looking at these numbers, the potential profit on this project was about $75,000 on a $30 million investment on the part of this developer. So the question here was, why would a developer possibly move forward on this site, and how could it be done? And that's where Tony's going to take over to walk you through that. Tony?
Thank you, Elaine. So this is an illustration of real estate deals involving brownfields. So looking at this pyramid as representative of potential deals, if a deal falls into the top of the pyramid, it means that the value of the proposed development exceeds remediation costs and other development costs. If projects land in the middle, then the project is considered marginal, and then a go or no-go depends on several factors, including what type of return will the developer and investor expect, and will banks and other lenders have a level of comfort in the project. And if the numbers fall on the bottom of the pyramid, then the project is considered upside down and likely will not work unless something changes. It should be noted that the pyramid is sort of representative of brownfield development out in the market. And that is that most proposed projects are on the lower level, upside down, and few are at the top because of the cost, time, and risk involved with brownfields. So if the deal is upside down, what can you do? So one way is to try and offset project expenses by using available public financing tools. Could be grants, low interest loans, tax incentives like tax increment financing that Elaine mentioned, or phase in the taxes on the new value of the project improvements over time. Other public sector involvement could include government uses on a portion of the site. Libraries, firehouses, public works, facilities as part of the development, and they could contribute infrastructure like roads and sewers to the development. Untraditional developers include brownfield developers who know how to assess the contamination, and they reduce risk and walk a cleanup through the regulatory process. It's something a lot of developers avoid because they don't have the background and they don't want to take the risk. There's also a group of developers who specialize in demolition and salvaging of metal from structures and any value that may exist in selling any remaining machinery on site. And in situations where bank and other financiers might balk at a developer buying a contaminated property, they may consider a long-term lease instead because there's no ownership of the underlying contamination. And developers in certain markets see the value of land increasing in the future. They may hold on to it or tie up a property until they're able to recruit tenants as the market improves. So the back of the envelope this one is similar to the earlier one Elaine showed, except the developer and the community have identified a $500,000 EPA grant and a $1.1 million state contribution to cover infrastructure costs. And that thereby lowers the developer's total cost by about $2.4 million, resulting in a potential profit to the developer in the deal. So at this point, a developer makes a choice whether to go to the next step with a deeper feasibility analysis. So the next step involves undertaking a proforma. And as the first bullet on the slide states, a proforma is a statement, usually a spreadsheet, that provides a clear representation of future cost and income and calculates projected returns on investment. Depending on the size and nature of a proposed development, proformas can be relatively simple or very sophisticated software that includes a variety of analysis and formulas that look at all aspects of the financials. Banks, investors, and public partners who may be providing grants or tax incentives, they're going to want to see that level of detail before they commit their funds. So one of the first steps leading to a detailed proforma is a breakdown of sources and uses of funds. Using the case study that Elaine introduced earlier, the uses column identifies the major categories of project costs: site acquisition, remediation costs, infrastructure costs, the actual hard construction cost, and then soft cost, engineering, architectural, and carrying costs during both the acquisition, the construction, and the leasing up period. And in this case, under uses column, there is no site acquisition cost, as the city owns the land and is contributing the land in hopes the development results in jobs and taxes. On the other side of the ledger are the sources of funds that will pay the identified cost. In this project, that includes the $500,000 EPA Brownfields grant, the proceeds from state tax increment financing, a first construction loan, and a second private mortgage loan, and significant developer equity. So at this stage, everyone wants to see that the sources and uses balance out. So Brownfields financing. So this slide illustrates the overall path of how a development is financed at different stages. It links back to two earlier slides that Elaine presented, one on the stages of redevelopment finance and another on the sources of financing. In this case, the site is contaminated, requires cleanup as part of the overall development. The developer obtains a 30-day option to buy the property. And options to buy are often longer and allow a developer time to undertake initial due diligence. During this time, which is often a stressful period, a lot of people are very busy conducting environmental assessments, reviewing documents, seeking initial entitlements around planning and zoning, and community support as well, and then identifying lenders who will sign on to the project. So in this case, the developer seeks conventional financing, but they were denied as the banks are concerned about the risk involved in environmental cleanup. So the developer turns to, quote, unconventional equity and debt as a source to finance the project. The source of these funds are very expensive, given the risk involved with cleanup, and often involve more of the developer's money as equity also. In this case, they're successful in obtaining funding. They purchase the site, undertake the cleanup, and begin down a path to seek tenants for the site in an effort to confirm that the site does have demand and convince those in conventional financing that there's now less risk involved, which allows the deal to be restructured, including obtaining a construction loan. As the project is built and tenants signed on, permanent financing can now be put into place and the funds in the form of developer equity and debt can be reduced. In this case, the project is eventually sold and a major Wall Street firm purchases the property. So the term cap rate is used daily in the real estate and development industry. You can find it on real estate brokers' brochures, advertising the sale of dollar store properties, and published on industry websites for various types of properties throughout the country. The quote capitalization rate is the annual rate of return on real estate based on the income that the property is expected to generate. The cap rate is used to estimate the value of a project when completed based upon expected income. So to determine the value of a completed project using the cap rate, you take the net operating income, known as the NOI, and you divide it by a chosen cap rate. And as you see on the slide, there are significant differences in the value of a project using different cap rates. So in real estate, a low, say, less than 5% cap rate often reflects a lower risk profile, whereas a higher cap rate, sort of greater than 7%, is often considered a riskier investment. So the role of leverage. So developers and investors, they use a lot of several financial tests and tools to determine if a project will be worth it to them to invest their money and make a good return on that money. So one of these is the role of leverage, that is using borrowed capital to increase the return on an investment. So the quote leveraged return is the rate of return on a developer's equity using the benefit of a loan at a cost lower than the rate of return. So in its simplest form, the more money a developer can borrow at a low rate means they use less of their own funds and at a rate that's advantageous to the developer and the project. So going back to Elaine's Midwest Industrial site, this is the performa, and here it's what we presented earlier, what Elaine presented earlier involving the redevelopment of a brownfield industrial site. The performa on this slide is simplified, but it shows the information and assumptions made to calculate the projected returns on investment. On the left-hand side of the performa, you find a summary of the project to be built, with the cost listed for a variety of factors that we talked about, such as infrastructure, remediation, hard cost to build or renovate buildings, soft cost, and the carrying cost. And the carrying costs here are the expenses on the property over the cost of owning it. And in this case, it's spread out over a 36-month period, which includes buying it, construction, and the lease up. And those costs include any mortgage payments, property taxes, insurance, and utilities during the time. So in this case, the development costs total almost $30.4 million. And we've assumed a public subsidy using a state tax credit to cover infrastructure costs and the EPA grant, together totaling almost $2.4 million. So what that does is it reduces the total development cost to the developer to just about $28 million. On the right-hand side, we identify the income from the leasing of the two buildings minus the vacancy factor, resulting in a net operating income, or NOI, of about $2.5 million. And again, to arrive at a project value using a cap rate of 8%, we divide the NOI by 0.08, resulting in a project value of almost $30.5 million. And finally, to determine what the profit is to the developer, you subtract the total development cost from the project value, resulting in approximately $2.5 million, or 11.3% profit to the developer. So the community role in redevelopment finance. As we've seen in the previous slides, there are times when the financing of a brownfield development project is underwater, and even the most well-intentioned developer can't make the numbers work without some type of involvement by a community partner or partners. This can be the EPA, state development agencies, development corporations, and municipalities. And as many of you know, there are numerous public financing tools out there. Some are available at the federal level, and most states have funding for economic development and housing, whether it be industrial development bonding, tax increment financing, opportunity zones, and most municipalities have tax incentives that provide infrastructure investments as part of a deal they see that's valuable to the community. And so understanding whether a deal makes financial sense for a developer is really important for community partners, to, as they often have to convince their own state or local legislative bodies and agencies that community participation is necessary and reasonable. And as important is the need to educate sort of the public on the value of developing brownfield sites, because hopefully they result in new jobs, taxes, and they improve the health of the community. So, Elaine, I think we're going to go to questions now.
Amy, would you like to lead them?
Yeah, I'm going to lead us off on our first question break. We definitely got some questions in, so thanks to everybody who's been offering up questions. Elaine, I want to start with going back to the sources of financing slide, where you shared, broke down kind of what private sector investment looks like, what public sector investment looks like, and what local institution investment looks like. Can you tell us a little bit about where a developer tends to look first for funding? Private, public investment, basically, like, which sources tend to be preferred for developers to use?
Well, it's a good question, and it certainly depends on the type of projects, and I think our two developers we're going to hear from in a little bit may also weigh in on this. But for starters, on a fairly easy, conventional redevelopment, you would go to conventional sources because they are, in most cases, the least cost, and they have the least number of restrictions. When you get into more complicated brownfields, your traditional banks may not want to get involved in that sort of thing because the risk is something they don't understand, and so you have to go out to other sources of lenders, including private investors, equity investors, hedge funds, that are all much higher interest rates, but they have the money and they're willing to take that risk. And you'll hear a little bit about the types of costs that this money comes with when you're talking about these big brownfields projects, and when we talk with our developers in a few minutes. Brownfields projects and larger ones that have, as I said, a lot of infrastructure costs, that's where you tend to go to more and more public financing support and other creative means such as nonprofits and institutions.
Super, thank you. The next question, Tony, you mentioned, you talked about a little bit about what happens within the 30-day option to buy. Can you share with us again, like, what is the developer doing that during that time? And I think you said that 30 days tends to be a short amount of time.
Sure. It really depends on the project and the nature of the project, and certainly the size and complexity of it. And particularly with brownfields, 30 days is not a long time. Oftentimes developers will either as in Elaine's example, the city has put an RFP out and or, you know, with a site and is interested in attracting people, and they have a site ready and they've done a lot of due diligence. So if a lot of that due diligence is done, it can be a short period. But if that work isn't done, and let's say phase ones, phase twos haven't been done, or even if phase one was done, but obviously phase twos and threes are sort of hanging out there, that's the period during which a developer is going to have to go out, hire environmental consultants, do their testing, do their further assessments, and so 30 days is not a long time. Sometimes it goes to a purchase and sales agreement after an initial option period, and again, when you go beyond the sort of the initial option period, you've got a situation where there may still be issues hanging out there, but you've gone through most of them. You've sort of come to terms on a price. You've come to terms on what type of cleanup is involved. And then, again, those sources and uses are the sort of the sources. Where is that money going to come from? Is it coming from the developer and his, their investors, or is it going to be some combination? So the 30-day, though, is, again, a short time period, but during whether it be 60 or 90 or 180 days, there's still a lot of sort of groundwork and legwork going on.
Super. Thank you. We got a couple questions in about the cap rate. And who figures out the cap rate? And again, like what's a low cap rate versus a high cap rate? I think you said 8% is a low one. So who figures it out? And what's kind of the range for low versus high?
Tony, you want to take that?
Sure. So it's really common kind of question, and the question is always like, what's a good cap rate? And what you're really asking is, what's a good return for this investment? And there's no universal cap rate to sort of target. It really depends on a lot of different factors that impact the difference in cap rates between properties, and as well as how one defines good. And, good as a term is used to describe a sort of a favorable investment that one might choose to make. So in determining a good cap rate, there's a couple factors that are really important. One is risk profile. So, this often goes with location. And it goes back to what Elaine was talking about earlier about different tiered markets. So, you can expect lower cap rates in San Francisco because there's probably less risk in San Francisco real estate, although it's tricky. But it's you have more probably risk in some of those fourth-tier markets or third-tier markets. And I don't want to mention any cities, but certain cities, are would be considered riskier. So with the risk, you get a higher cap rate, and you get a lower cap rate where you have less risk. Time is another factor with cap rates, because cap rates can change over time. They change with the economy, and it has to do either with the local economy or a national economy. Cap rates have to take into consideration the asset type. So are we talking about multifamily, office, distribution centers, or we'll say hotels? So multifamily, for the most part, tend to have lower cap rates, and things that are riskier, like hotels, tend to have higher cap rates. And also, in leasing situations, a lot has to do with the strength of the lease. So like solid, single tenant leases, let's say, to an Amazon for 10 years with options to renew, would generally be a lower cap rate. And whereas if you had, say, an office building or a distribution industrial sort of park with 10 smaller tenants who have varying degrees of sort of credit and varying degrees of their times on their leases, you would probably have to look at a higher cap rate.
Tony, so that's really helpful. But who's the actual like entity that figures out what the cap rate will be? Is that something
sure.
the developer does, bank does, or the lender? How does that work?
Sure. So, and our two developers later could probably do that because they've probably done lots of had to look at cap rates a lot. But for the most part, it's you know, as I said earlier, you can go on to any of the national larger real estate firms across country. They sort of publish and they sort of track cap rates for all these different assets and different buildings, different geographic locations. And so there's no one person. There's no sort of national, you know, federal agency. I mean, they probably do. There is some agency who probably does include cap rates, but it generally tends to be more regional and sort of industry-wide, and a lot of historical tracking. So in other words, there's a lot of historical tracking. Let's say pick a state or pick San Francisco, for instance. You could go and look at the last 10 years of cap rates. And so you're sort of tracking that. Someone's tracking that, again, the large industrial or the large real estate firms. And you tend to use those sources.
Great. I have two more quick questions here, and there are a couple more questions that came in, but I want to save them for after our developer speak. So the two questions that I will ask our presenters right now to address is, one came in, if site cleanup and remediation costs increased excessively, is that covered by any grants, or how is that dealt with?
Well, I'll start and say by typically you don't have time in the middle of the project when costs are increasing, because it's often when you've already committed and you're in the work that you find out that it increases, and it may increase because you found more material than was expected, you found contamination that you didn't know about, or perhaps there's been such delays that it's costing you more in order to cover those remediation or other costs on the project because of various delays. And so that's not the time to be filing grant applications. So usually that's covered by the investors. It's covered by them going back, the owners themselves, the developers themselves putting in more of their own personal equity and going back and either getting additional financing from the marketplace or additional investors in the project. And it can also come off of their bottom line of profit.
Great. Thank you.
Which is why it's risky.
Yes. So one last question before we move on. This is a question about the pro forma itself. So the question is the rate per square foot for income the rate over an entire year or per month, or what's the unit there?
Tony, do you want to explain that?
Sure. So it's in this case, it's the cost per square foot for, and you can see how it translates. So in the example we use with Elaine's project, it was actually phases to this project. In other words, they were going to build, take an existing building on site, renovate it, put up a new warehouse, and that was the first phase. And that's what's shown in the pro forma. And then it goes on to a second and third phase. So what you're looking at in the pro forma that was shown is per square foot for $4.15 times the size of the building gives you the number. So it's the amount of money per square foot per really for on an annual basis.
Thank you, Tony. Okay, thanks everyone for your questions. Like I said, there's a couple more that we got that we're gonna save, and please everyone else send your questions in and we'll have more time at the end.
Great, thanks, Amy. I just, before we introduce our two developers, remind everybody about two things going on at the Brownfields Conference. Everything at the Brownfields Conference will be great, but two things we want to note. This workshop we're doing on the 10th, you will get the opportunity to act as a developer, work in a team, and attempt to buy a very large, complex brownfield. You will get to work through the issues. We'll be there. We'll work with you. Last time we did it in California, we had a bidding war, and it was a lot of fun. We'll have equity investors in the room. You guys will be spending more money than you'll probably make. But, you know, if you get the deal, you can retire. So it's going to be a lot of fun, 12 to 4 on the 10th at the conference. You do have to sign up ahead of time because materials will be provided ahead of time, so please check that out. The other thing I want to mention is that is one of the developers that I'll be introducing will be speaking at this breakfast hosted by CCLR. It's Wednesday morning. Amy will say a few words. Either Chad or Jed from North Point will say a few words. It's a great opportunity to kind of see under the tent, see what's going on, and we're going to focus on the development world and how to get deals done. So that's another good opportunity. You do have to sign up for that, but it's free, and CCLR will be feeding us breakfast that morning. Okay, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. Chad Meyer is the president of North Point Development. North Point is one of the fastest growing industrial developers in the country. They do other things, but Chad never talks about any of that. They own all kinds of stuff. But I think they're going to top $500 million this year. Super aggressive, take on all kinds of brownfields. And what's great, you know, that I see is that they continue to own their property. They don't buy, build, and flip. So if there are environmental issues, trailing environmental issues, it's always good to have the same owner that is going to deal with them. So, Chad, you ready to go?
Yes, sir. Prepare to be underwhelmed. All right. Well, thanks for the intro, Mike. So just as a quick introduction, North Point Development, we have, we're headquartered in Kansas City, have offices in St. Louis, Cincinnati, Chicago, York, Pennsylvania, Detroit, Sacramento, and Seattle, and I really need one in Philly and Dallas. But anyway, so what, as Mike said, we buy anywhere from 3,000 to 3,500 acres a year of land just to feed our industrial platform. And on the vertical side, that equates to we build roughly 14 million square feet of industrial and manufacturing space on an annual basis, and a lot of that is with repeat tenants like General Motors, Adidas, Chewy.com, Amazon, of course, and then and you know, FedEx, UPS, a lot of the big occupiers. And if it were up to us, we would absolutely positively go to the next interchange out, go buy a nice soybean field that's never had anything on it, and be off to the races. But the reality is all the easy sites are gone. We're in the 10th year of a pretty strong industrial boom, and it doesn't look like it's going to slow down for the next 18 to 24 months. And so what that's forced us to do, and we enjoy it, so it hasn't been a fight, but to go look at more infill, you know, grittier, former manufacturing, former military base, former chemical plant type sites for a couple of reasons. The big push is that the infrastructure is there, and typically you go into a municipality with a large brownfield presence, and the city sat and looked at a blighted area or areas where a community has concerns about groundwater contamination, things like that. So if you're there to come in, offer a means to clean these things up and put people back to work, then the cities are typically pretty happy to see you. The other thing that's really shifted in the industrial market, and we, you know, we use data to drive our decisions, but labor's kind of the name of the game, and Amazon's the one that really opened our eyes to that. We're chasing a big project for them up in the Cleveland area. Thought we had the perfect site, perfect logistics, best tax base. Thought we had them nailed, and they squared out on a site 11 miles away that didn't make any sense to us. And so what they finally said was, yeah, taxes were lower. We could have started construction easier. Access to the interstate was better. But when you look at a 25-mile drive time, there weren't enough employees in the immediate area for us to staff and then maintain our operations. And so HR says, if there's not enough employees, we're not going to go build a $100 million building that we're going to have to run at 60 to 70% capacity because we can't get enough employment. We'll go to a lesser location from a logistics, a more expensive location if needed, but we have to be able to prove that we can reemploy this place a couple times over, because warehouse type businesses have a high attrition rate of 30 to 40% a year and sometimes higher. So it's really where that demographic is. And as we all know, a lot of that more affordable, you know, $60,000 to $110,000 housing stock is basically the stuff that was built after World War II through the Vietnam era, and built up around a lot of the big manufacturing bases. And those are more the, you know, kind of blue collar warehouse work type worker housing stock that we need to be able to support the operations of facilities. And so e-commerce is kind of replacing the shopping malls as a way that people buy. And every time a shopping mall dies, a warehouse gets its wings, which we really love. But the reality is an Amazon warehouse that employs 2,400 people, even though they're not sexy jobs, they're still jobs. In a lot of places, that's a greater employment base than the shopping mall or the former manufacturing site ever employed. And so cities are starting to wake up to that and realize that e-commerce fulfillment centers and manufacturing centers aren't evil. They're actually good, and they're what communities need. So that's why we've been hyper-focused on finding large redevelopment opportunities, which typically involve some environmental contamination due to their historic nature. So next slide, please. So so basically I wanted to just kind of highlight a project and then talk about what helped from a regulatory and a municipal standpoint. So the project that we're looking at now was a former mall that has some manufacturing around it, but the mall had basically, it was built in the 70s, kind of hit its heyday in the mid 80s, like a lot of malls. They had seven, you know, marquee anchor retailers between Dillard's, JCPenney, Macy's, Cinemark Theaters, you know, all the big name brands. And over time, as people's shopping patterns changed, the mall, like a lot of malls in America, just kind of started to dwindle. And at the end of the day, this thing was being used as a Hispanic bazaar and a haunted house. Not exactly what the city of Arlington, Texas wanted. So we came in, were able to acquire the mall and redevelop it with a new warehouse, and then General Motors ended up leasing both warehouses from us. And the main reason was it was close to their plant, but also if you looked at the demographics within about a 20-mile radius, they said that they could show up with 1,400 employees day one, ramping up to 3,000, and there was enough blue-collar employment base around there where they thought they could employ this facility with a 300% attrition rate, which is way more than they would ever see, so that it was a safe bet for them to enter into a 12 and a 15-year lease with us on this. So, you know, from a helpfulness standpoint, we did have to get some of the state agencies as well as the cities basically on board. You know, the mall had a special place in the heart of a lot of the locals, but they had also realized, you know, this thing was kind of on its last legs, if not already dead. And so they finally got on board and realized that manufacturing and a distribution center were going to be better than watching this thing continue to deteriorate and the crime around it. So there was some environmental contamination involved with this. Fortunately, when you're bringing new jobs, new investment, everybody's on board. The biggest thing that we were able to do is get the state as well as the local municipality to kind of lock arms with us and allow a lot of that redevelopment to occur during the demolition and construction process. So the most important thing for us is that we're able to do kind of a side-by-side testing program through demolition, kind of, you know, be able to fly the plane or continue building the plane while we were mid-flight, set a soil management program, handled the cleanup as part of the construction process, and we didn't have to wait for, you know, months of go do testing, go work up a soil management plan, then implement it, wait for demolition to happen, go back, clean everything up and go. In this case, the regulatory agencies were super helpful in the fact that we basically set a laundry list of things. If you encounter this, then this is the remediation, and we were able to keep really 100% of the on-site material, or 100% of the material on-site, treated on-site, and we did that through having ongoing full-time testing, and then since we had a kind of a prescribed soil management plan, we were able to take care of things as they popped up. And if I'm, please speak up, Mike, if I'm wandering in a direction you don't want me to, but I think, again, this is a great example of a failed shopping mall. Our total investment on this was $168 million, and so, which is more than it cost to build the mall. The beautiful thing about the mall was it was 100 acres, it was flat, and it had a lot of electricity and sewer water, just like any mall would have. And so a lot of that infrastructure was able to be reused without the city having to pony up and put in new infrastructure to support the manufacturing and the distribution. And, you know, at full tilt boogie, this thing will have, you know, brushing up against 3,000 full-time employees here. So it was really a win-win. The other beautiful thing about e-commerce and manufacturing is that what the city is able to enjoy is income taxes, as well as ad valorem or the real estate taxes plus personal property taxes. Obviously, we love it when we get big abatements to keep the operating costs down. But the thing that the cities have really seen is that a lot of these e-commerce facilities and the manufacturers love seeing this type of reuse come in. A, it's obviously a big engineered control, so you really help change the risk profile from an environmental standpoint. But also, a lot of these companies will offer work programs to where high school students who aren't going on to college or secondary education can actually work, you know, afternoon shifts and then weekend shifts, get their CTL or their forklift training, things like that on the job. And then the companies that need employees have a nice pipeline of employment base that they can count on. And then the cities have said that once their citizens or their constituents see higher employment rates, they actually witness drops in human welfare calls to the fire and police. So instead of, you know, thinking you got a cold, you call the fire department because you need a ride to the hospital to get a checkup. You know, these people are at work, they got benefits, they got jobs, they got money. And, you know, in addition to the incremental tax revenue, the burden on the local fire and police and hospital systems actually drops. And so it's really a win-win when we can find these kind of brownfields or infill sites and put them back into productive use. All right, next slide. As we mentioned, labor is the name of the game. So what we did here was looked at a former Navy weapons and aviation manufacturing campus in the heart of Dallas. And so they were doing all the good stuff. They're doing everything from firing depleted uranium rounds into a berm for a while, back in the good old days of the military. And they also had on-site treatment for their chromium and their anodization process. And a lot of that treatment also meant that, well, when you're done with all the chemicals, dump them in this big hole in the ground, and they just kind of go away on their own. And, you know, that was done through the 40s and 50s. And the cleanup was pretty extensive. But again, this is an area at its peak when the military was making the B-1 bombers, the Corsair fighter jets, and then even made parts of the space shuttle here at this site in the middle of Dallas. There's 23,000 people that worked at this campus. And over time, as the military moved a lot of the production out of state or overseas, and the need for military aircraft kind of dwindled, this place basically shut down. The beautiful part to us, and the reason we were so interested in taking on a super hairy environmental site, was that it was basically 400 acres in the heart of Dallas that you couldn't necessarily find anywhere else. But the image on the right is a heat map of the labor demographics, strictly from the perspective of an e-commerce or a warehousing or manufacturing employee. And so the way we are able to find those is the U.S. Census data has tapestries, which basically give the wage type, the NAICS codes, which are the employment codes for the type of workers that would include forklift drivers, CDL or commercial truck drivers, pick and pack operators, just general warehouse workers, as well as office managers and shipping receiving managers, things like that. So you take all those NAICS codes or employment profiles, that with the Experian credit data, we can actually map where those people live. And so this is basically like a storm map. So the darker red means the greater density of that employment profile or that employee profile. And so if you look at where this is, it's the dot right in the middle of the map. And within about 7 miles, we had thousands of available workforce. And as we tracked them, a lot of them were driving over 25 minutes away from where they live to find the jobs in the manufacturing plants and the warehouses. And so this one really kind of made the hockey buzzer go off for us because it was a big site, had good scale. There was rail, there was existing water, existing sewer, heavy, heavy power that was available because it had to support the manufacturing of the aircraft in its heyday. That was still there and was basically being unused by the city of Dallas. Plus it had scale to build a nice big campus. But the real attractive part was that despite all the environmental hurdles, it was surrounded by that blue collar worker profile that we look for. And if you're a new company wanting to make a major investment in a new facility, having the ability to have a 15,000 employee recruiting base within 10 miles of your new facility is a wonderful thing, especially at a tight unemployment market. So anyway, this is one where the state was aware of it. They knew it was a problem. Dallas was screaming to get anything done here, but the environmental had scared away all the previous developers. And so this really involved getting with TCEQ or the state of Texas, getting with the city, the county, and the EPA, because there was some, federal level contamination at some point when this thing was transitioned. And basically said, okay, well, the beautiful part of what we do is we're going to come in, we know what we're going to build. We're going to cover the whole site with engineered controls. Those engineered controls are just going to happen to look like big concrete warehouses with massive concrete truck courts. We can control where the storm runoff goes from here on out. We can detain the runoff. And we'll also be able to test before the stuff gets dumped into Mountain Creek Lake, which is a lake just to the southwest of this site that had been contaminated. There's ongoing dredging. Fish tissue samples were, glowing green. A lot of issues. And so again, this is one where the fact that we knew we were coming in with a massive industrial development, you know, in the form of big concrete warehouses and big concrete truck courts, that we deed restricted the entire property to a commercial industrial use and got the state to allow us to basically do a prescribed soil management plan where we, again, kind of had the shopping list of if we hit TCE, this is the remediation. If you hit L-NAPL, this is it. If you hit chromium, this is that. If you hit our, you know, carbonic acid, this is the way you manage it. And so we had it product kind of prescribed. We ended up paying a testing agency to have 2 to 3 full-time testing agents out there. And as we found soil with odors or discoloration, we'd do rapid lab tests, get it tested, identify it, document it, document the cleanup. And again, on a 400-acre site, at the end of the day, I think we only hauled about 160 yards off-site that we had to treat. The rest of it, we were able to, you know, either treat it with lime or mix in with other suitable soil, put it underneath the parking lots, cap it with rock, and then for the most part, none of it ever left the site. So it was a great outcome. The punchline on the whole story is we ended up tearing down 2.5 million square feet of old, nasty, asbestos-laden, you know, chemical-filled pipes, everything. And we're able to get, and so this place had gone from 23,000 full-time employees to basically 3 security guards that were drunk most of the time. And so it basically had 0 employment base. The tax base had dwindled away, and it was becoming kind of a hot spot for crime, things like that. We ended up tearing everything down. Home Depot signed a 20-year lease with us, and they actually opened the first half of the facility about a month ago. And at full tilt, Boogie, they're going to have about 1,500 full-time employees with benefits, and we're working on another tenant. And Home Depot basically located here because of that existing infrastructure that was so important. But they said the single deciding factor was the fact that they had that blue-collar labor force that surrounded this former manufacturing facility. And at the end of the day, since we're going to own the building long-term, Home Depot was not afraid of the environmental, you know, and the ongoing monitoring because they weren't in the chain of title. They're simply leasing the building from us. And we were able to place a PLL policy on the facility with Home Depot as a named insured, and they were comfortable enough to go ahead and sign a long-term lease. So again, great success story. And it really involved coming with a redevelopment plan that incorporated the remediation plan into the demolition and construction progress. And it was couldn't have been done without TCEQ and the city and all the other regulatory agencies really stepping up to see the end game here. Not just point out everything that was wrong with the site, but what we could actually do with the site and how we could take what could have been a year-long process, truncate it into a couple of months so that we could start construction.
That's great, Chad. Really appreciate it. Maybe next year we'll have you back and you can talk about Houston, Northern California, the other sites you're working on. So really appreciate it. Great stuff. And I'd like to move on to our second developer. This would so if you think about the development world, North Point might be the largest industrial developer out there, one of them, private industrial developer, and these guys, this is the company right here, Steve Parnes and Mike McMullen. Great guys, have done a lot of complex stuff. They're going to talk to you about a site in New Jersey they've just finished, a lot of complicating issues. I will say Mike is going to be one of our equity investors at the workshop at the pre-conference, so you'll get to meet him if you come out. But Steve, why don't you take it away? You got about 20 plus minutes here to get through your project.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon, everyone. Basically, Catalyst is really 2 employees, Mike McMullen and myself, 2 partners that went out on our own about a little over 5 years ago. Based in Connecticut in the tri-state area and California, though all of our projects seem to always revolve around New Jersey, and that's where we've been focused. It just worked its way out there, and the New Jersey market for the brownfields has been a very good market in the last 5 years. The Gerdau, we've done about 2.5 million square feet. We've just literally finished all of our projects, all three of them, between the three of them, in the last 3 or 4 months. One for the project you're going to see for 1,300,000 square feet, 1,100,000 square feet on another property, and about 150,000 on another property in the Meadowlands, all to be industrial. So we think we've created a next slide, please. We think we based on all of our conversations, we know we've created about $3.3 million in new annual taxes on those projects. All of them were defunct, underperforming properties, literally nothing going on them at all. And we've created about 1,500 jobs on the different projects. One in Florence, New Jersey. We'll talk about the Perth Amboy project and the Meadowlands. The Gerdau steel plant, the former steel plant that you're looking at on the screen, was what our focus had been on, very good real estate in very bad shape with very big environmental issues, but in good markets. This, to us, when we saw this property, was 92 acres right located in Perth Amboy, which, to follow up on Chad's point, in a great job market, a lot of employee based here, convenient to the port, very close to the port of Newark, close to New York City, close to the New Jersey Turnpike, the Garden State Parkway, and other major roadways, on the Raritan Bay with a train line right next to it and a train station within 2 blocks of the site. The steel plant had been closed for about 7 years, so there were literally no jobs there. There was a small leaseback property that Gerdau was using to bend rebar that they were then using the dock and sending that rebar off for the Tappan Zee Bridge project that has now been finished. But that was where a lot of the rebar was coming from their other plant, and they were using this as a bending and transportation hub. They also have kept that 8 acres, which led to a whole bunch of different complications during the process of remediation, demolition, and so forth, which I'll get into in a few minutes. But the real problem with this site wasn't the steel plant that was about 40 years old. It was built in the late 70s. It was the former Anaconda copper smelter plant that had been there for 80 years prior, and then whatever use was before that. We believe before that there was a brick plant in the 1800s. But the site had had a lot of different industrial uses, a lot of different buildings on it, and a lot of contamination due to that steel plant. Next slide, please. That is a picture of what is being built now, just so you can see the end product. It's about it's two buildings. It is a build-to-suit for Home Depot. We did the horizontal development. That has been our specialty, doing all the rough contamination, the rezoning, the raising the site out of the floodplains with alternative fill, clean fill, the whole gamut, and doing all that site work. We then sold it to a REIT who is building a build-to-suit for Home Depot. It is their new modular, modern logistics center. Operation where they're going to be doing more warehousing direct to consumers and to commercial builders and others, and they'll be picking up things there instead of having to go into stores. And Home Depot's, doing this whole process across the country. Next slide, please. So as I had mentioned, there's a train station within 2 blocks. The Outerbridge crossing was only a half mile away, and you had all access, as you can see from the slide, to everywhere in New Jersey. The location was a top-level location, had a direct from the steel plant. They had a truck route, which was also a public roadway that was falling apart, directly up to 440 and to the turnpike, which made it much easier that you could avoid driving through the downtown. Next slide, please. So I'll get into some of this, but part of the process was when we acquired this, I'll go into the whole acquisition process, which was interesting. But we worked, the Perth Amboy has a redevelopment agency. Sitting on the redevelopment agency, which was actually very helpful to us, was a representative from New Jersey DEP. Having that person there was a very good way to expedite the project, because as Mike and Chad mentioned, time and Elaine, time on these things and getting them done in a timely way is the key to these projects, and having someone directly at DEP who was involved literally in our meetings on negotiating the redevelopment agreement and attended most of those meetings came in very valuable help in the end and later on when we needed certain permits expedited. So basically, we ended up with a public amenity package to the city of Perth Amboy of about $6.4 million. We'll show you later on the overall site plan that there's going to be an amphitheater on the water that is going to be built for over 200 people, plus, you know, a public space. We donated a historic building on site and the money to renovate it. We'll be renovating it. We donated the acquisition funds to buy land adjacent to our site that was also adjacent to a senior center that is going to then be laid out and creating an outdoor space for them, an outdoor exercise area. And what this also did was no one from the public had ever had access to the site over to the waterfront here for over, you know, 80 years. We've dedicated over 10% open space, and there'll be walkways around the site to get down to the waterfront where the amphitheater will be, where there is some extra land that has been donated that will also be landscaped for people to be able to have access to the water. Next slide, please. So, as I mentioned, there was a copper smelter here. All of our testing, all of the seller's testing had been based on, and their own work had been based on what was in the steel plant. What we went looking for during the due diligence period was what was here from before then, and we knew it was bad. Originally, the whole deal had been contingent upon us closing when the remedial action work plan was approved. Seller decided that that was going to take too long and then came back to us and wanted it done when the remedial investigation was complete and approved, which sounded okay, and we needed to convince our equity partners, and I'll go into our funding partners shortly. We convinced them that that was possible. Well, they came back to us, the seller, and said, you know what, we just want to close in 2 months from that time period. We don't want to wait till the remedial investigation is complete, and we want you to put up a very large remediation funding source, which we need you to come up with and us to approve. And we want a 50% escrow on top of that, just in case you're wrong. So that was kind of the changes that happened. And as all real estate development projects happen, they never go as planned. It's why we have a timeline, and we, you know, try and meet those timelines in a linear look. Things happen. We call those, on this call, the oh my God moments. We have much more colorful language privately, but you add in the fact that it's a brownfield project on top of the real estate development project, and you're dealing with a property that's had historic uses on here, and you have issues coming up. We were able to put together the funding source. We were able to do enough investigation during that due diligence period where we got comfortable with what we thought was there, and that was going back to the copper smelter, all the arsenic, PCBs, and other issues. Back in the day when they demoed the copper smelter in the early 1970s, the environmental regulations weren't what they are today, and they basically just smeared the site like your morning bagel and cream cheese. They just pushed it all down to the river. They pushed it all over the site. So whatever contamination was, they spread it over those years, and they just demoed buildings in place and to the source that we didn't know what was where, and all the building plans we looked at were far from accurate. And we ended up, in the end, actually being very accurate on our environmental, that we came in below budget on the remediation funding source, and the escrow after the RAOs are issued, after the building's built, we will get back that $3.7 million. So our investors were quite happy on that. Next slide, please. So part of what we did, being on the Raritan Bay and what the seller Gerdau wanted was, and our equity partners wanted, was the point of being, be the most conservative you can be on the environmental. In other words, they wanted to see a slurry wall. We planned out a slurry wall. It was funny during a call with the seller's consultants when they hired a different consultant who said, well, you don't even need the slurry wall. Well, it was a good fun moment to go at the seller a little bit, but our plan always was to build this slurry wall. It's a 4,400 lineal square foot slurry wall. It was up to 75 feet deep down by the water. It was actually constructed in only 3 months. It was quite impressive to watch. At its depth, it may be 75 feet deep, but it's only 3 feet wide. And we had spent 6 months of design work with that, and it was an interesting process to watch. And I got to say, it was a great consultant. And the fact that they could get that done in 3 months and we were under budget on it was a great thing. And it, all testing, it's working just great. We also removed PCBs, arsenic soils, but the main plan was to cap the site with fill. And so during that process, we brought in 500,000 tons of fill to raise the site, to cap it, to raise it out of the floodplain, being on the water. The site had flooded during Superstorm Sandy pretty heavily. So that was our plan, because you need the buildings up and out, and you need a very solid base for the new modern industrial buildings that you're building. Next slide, please. So this is a overall site plan. We tried to show the public amenities you'll see in the bottom in blue and orange. That is the amphitheater down there. Yes, it's actually by the train line, which should make interesting concerts when they have it. The walking trails that went up and around are the light green lines that go up, and then the public space up on the top on the orange is where the senior center is and where that's going to have access to the site and also have the land we donated to them and are redoing. Also, the main roadway coming through the site is now going to be, and required by the city, it will be dedicated to the city. They will own it, and people are allowed to go through it. This was an interesting process because most industrial tenants are not going to want a public roadway through the two sites, and we had to design around that factor. That actually allowing them to drive through the site will open up the whole south end of the town where they've had major traffic congestion. This will be another route to get up to the turnpike and into 440, the outer bridge crossing, for the people on that south side of the town. In that process, we ended up having to move a public sewer line that was on our site, and, of course, we ended up paying for it. We ended up moving another water line off-site that came up after the fact that the city wanted, which will improve the flow of water in the whole area. So that's the overall site. The top building is actually the leaseback building that Gerdau is continuing to own. It's about 8 acres. It was built only about 7 years ago, and that's where they, as I said, bend rebar. We did get it approved, though, if they ever do vacate it, since we do own the land, for another 110,000 square feet at a later time. Next slide, please. Oh, could you go back one slide? I'll just mention one other thing. Part of the public amenities going on is that whole train line, New Jersey Transit, is going to be raising that line. It's low. Superstorm Sandy had a major effect on it. They're still using it, but they intend to raise the line. On the other side of the street and the train line is a public park that's being built with DEP funding, and that once that train line is raised, there's going to be a connection from that public park under the train line to the whole amphitheater area. So that was an important part for the city as well. Next slide, please. So when we evaluated the project, and the risk, you have the real estate risk is obviously the economy, the market. We bought the site. It wasn't zoned. The whole plan needed to be amended. We had already met with the city and felt that they were going to do that, and we were going to need a payment in lieu of tax agreement. And then, of course, always the underground geotechnical is a major issue. The brownfield risk is obviously the brand, you know, the cost overruns. We took care of the natural resource damages in the sense that we did not take on the liability for the off-site environmental or the natural resource damages. That's something we could never get our hands around, and we left that with the seller since they were already responsible. So that was part of the way we, you know, quantified the risk for us. We were dealing with the on-site and dealing with everything that could possibly leave the site. We took care of that, which should make it better for them when, if and when they have to deal with the natural resource damage claims. Next slide, please. So why did we do it, and why did we take that risk, and why were we able to convince a private equity fund? Because you'll see later, this development, the original budget was over $28 million. And because of the environmental risk we were taking, all of that was basically equity cash. There would be no debt possible for this type of deal. This property, you know, as I think you've seen, the location and access and size there in the New Jersey market, in the northern New Jersey market, are, you know, irreplaceable. You can't find sites this big, which, you know, was part of the fun of it. Looking back, it was a lot more fun looking back than it was sometimes during the process. But, you know, it was something that, you know, we can talk about for the rest of our careers. We proudly talk about. We had the ability. We did compartmentalize the risk, as you saw, even though we were only able to do due diligence on testing, not getting the RI approved. That, you know, was a risk factor, and it was something that, you know, we had to explain to our investors. We had to explain and prove out to the seller. They were very involved with understanding that and having their own consultants and attorneys looking at it. And, of course, we didn't accept the NRD of the offsite. But the industrial market has only gotten better in New Jersey. You know, that is something obviously none of us control. But it was something that we felt the market was strong, and if it was stayed where it was, we'd be very happy. It's gotten better, thankfully, for all of us, because it's making other projects more feasible. So that was a one major factor. Next slide, please. So the big surprise that we found, and as I said, there's the oh my God moments, was the buried industrial waste throughout the site. We had an idea. We didn't know where everything was. We didn't have enough time to do enough testing, but we knew there were problems. But we found everything we needed to find and didn't want to find. Mostly a lot of underground structures, a lot of things that were never showing up on the plans and never been documented. They were there, and they had to be dealt with. We had to do a lot of underground demolition and taking out structures, voids. We found having a leaseback property when they wanted power coming from a substation that was on site and us needing to turn off, demo that substation so we could demo the buildings without any real plans on where the electrical wires went, where the water lines were. None of these really were documented. And what we did have wasn't accurate. So we found all these underground structures. That's where our big budget bust came in. We found into the substation that no one knew that there was an oil-filled electrical transmission line. Thankfully, a PSE&G rep had been out there when we were doing some of the pre-demo work and told us about it. And even more thankfully, PSE&G couldn't find any paperwork that said we were responsible for removing the cost of it, so they had to pay for that. However, we did have to find remove a Praxair line and pay for all those extra things, including keeping Gerdau's power source available while we demoed the building. It was an interesting process, to say the least, of not knowing where anything was under there. In addition, we found a lot of buried railroad ties that had been on the site for years, but the more you dug down, the more you had to deal with them. And, of course, you have to pay to get rid of them and dispose of them properly. Next slide, please. So our project budget, on the whole, on the remediation, we were on budget. We did have a lot of unanticipated costs, about $3 million in non-budgeted items. That was a problem. That became a big problem with our investors. But it's something, thankfully, that the market was so good in New Jersey, we were able to work through. A lot of agita to try and explain that because it was $3 million more in cash that had to be put in, which, you know, some came out of our pockets, but mostly out of theirs. and involved us having to, we were doing another project with them, cross-collateralizing any money we made on the other project in case the budget increases went here above what we anticipated. So that was not a fun process to go through, and is one of those things as the oh my God moment. The entitlements, we were required, the city then wanted us to do a full engineered site plan, which we hadn't intended to do, which took more time and money. But we were able to deal with it, and we actually met our time frames. We had performed 3 years to get the project done. We added all some of these extra tasks that nobody anticipated, and we were still able to get it done in literally 1 month early, in just 35 months. So that part was helpful. But as I said, the $3 million extra cost was not a fun conversation. Next slide, please. So overall, you know, you look at it, when you're dealing with private equity firms as that with a fund, they're looking for higher returns. If they're willing to take this kind of risk on a project, they want big returns. And they get the majority. They were putting in, you know, the majority of the cash. And it was a lot of cash. It's, you know, it's a big investment for any one group to take on and to risk that kind of money on a project. Time frame, we did meet our time frames. Our project sale, you know, will show you that there was, you know, roughly an $18 million profit. But when you divide that over 3 years with the carry cost of the private equity firm that needed their returns on a yearly basis, it adds up. And I think this project versus the second or third tier market, being in New Jersey, being in the first tier market, is what kept it moving forward. We had a lot of interest from buyers. As I said, we did the horizontal development. We had a lot of vertical industrial development firms that wanted to buy it from us that normally would never take on the hair of dealing with the environmental, the underground structures, all the site work we did here, all the alternative fill, and all the permits that needed to go in with that. They wouldn't deal with it. But they, you know, doing the vertical, they want to pay you a premium for that. We entered into a contract, I would say, about 8 months into the process. Maybe looking back, it was too early, but you never know that because the market could change on you very quickly. It worked out well. As I said, they're doing a build-to-suit for Home Depot. It's going to be bringing about 600 to 700 jobs. The annual taxes here on the site are going to be $2.3 million. It's a pilot agreement, and they'll only be increasing every few years. In addition, you know, all the taxes that are created from the jobs and the people working there, and, you know, based on what Home Depot believes, what we believed before then, probably 60 to 70% of those jobs are all going to be local people who are leaving Perth Amboy right now to work elsewhere. So when they get this built and they do the job fairs, I think that the majority of people will be coming here. We were actually required to put a lot of bike racks in here because they always felt that, you know, the people could actually bike to the site and live nearby to avoid car traffic. In addition, with DEP being involved in our meetings early on, they required green infrastructure, which we did do, biobasins. And as I said, having the rep from DEP there was able to help us sometimes expedite and explain to their own internal people that, yes, this is a very real project. There's real public benefits here that are significant, that the city's behind it. And I think it helped get things done internally there. Even though we had an LSRP, you still needed DEP approvals on different things such as waterfront development permits and other things we had needed to do to be able to get the site work done. Because as everyone will tell you, time on these projects is what kills you. The longer it drags, the more the return's going to go to the private equity investor, the less profit, and the bigger danger of the market falling apart on you, which is the scariest thing for any developer. In this case, you know, we hit the market right, and it's continued to be good, but as we all know, no one knows how long that's going to go on for. So with the public amenities, the jobs, and the taxes, it's a project that we look back very as a very successful project. It was a interesting process. I'd like to look back and say it was fun. At times it really was fun, and it was great working with a lot of the people. but there were a lot of moments when dealing with some of those underground structures, some of the demolition, and just some of the process that just dragged. But that's just real estate development for you, and much more amplified when you're doing a brownfield project.
We want to turn it over to Amy to ask a few questions.
Yeah, thank you. That was excellent. Thank you so much to our developers for walking us through it. We definitely got a few questions in, so let me get started. For our developers, do you think there's a rule of thumb relative to a developer's profit margin when accepting the risk included with a brownfield redevelopment? Basically, like, what kind of, you know, return are you expecting because you're assuming a higher risk with the brownfield?
Mike, do you want me to answer that, or?
Yeah, Amy, do you want, I guess anybody can answer, right?
Yeah,
Chad,
anybody can answer. Yep.
Mike, Steve?
From our perspective, and Chad may be different because he owns the buildings, which is something that we intend to do in the future ourselves as well, is probably build. But we're looking at the land and land development and having private equity investors, you know, not banks, not traditional lenders. We are trying to, you know, build to a, on an annual basis, a 20 to 25% return, because we all know that there's going to be something that comes up. And in this case, you know, the $3 million extra cost came up regarding all the underground structures and some of the other utility issues that we had.
Great.
Yeah, this is Chad. We look at it a little differently because, again, we don't ever have like a basically a sale. So what we typically do is we charge a fee. It's paltry. We can barely keep our lights on, but it's anywhere from 3.5% to 5% of the total project cost. And then, that's the fee we charge, which helps us pay, you know, employees and our accountants and property managers. But then the way we can actually pay everybody is that we collect a portion of the rent proceeds. So it would consider it just like buying a house, where if someone said, hey, go buy a couple rental properties for me, we essentially charge a 3 to 5% fee to go put the deals together, get them teed up, set up, in position, and then when the renter comes in, we, you know, in our case, it's a big industrial occupier. You buy a building and you have a mortgage on it, which is, you know, hopefully a long-term non-recourse 20 to 30 year mortgage. And then whatever you can charge in rent that is in excess of what your debt coverage or your loan payments are is the spread you make. And so in some cases, you know, once you have net rents coming in, we can make 10 to 15% dividends on an ongoing basis. But really, the cash fees that we charge are 3 to 5%, and we typically leave those in the deal so that we have a larger stake of equity in the deal if we do have to have partners in. So it's just a difference, like the guys previously said, they do need to make a profit because it's risky, and, you know, everybody looks real smart right now because the tide's rising just about everywhere, but another 2008 happens and there's no one to sell to or no one to rent to, and you have tens of millions of dollars tied up, then your returns do need to be risk adjusted. And there's a ton of risk, especially on the land and horizontal side, that definitely warrants a 20 to 25% return. And as they said, you're pretty happy when you actually hit it, because by the time you get back down to the end of the project, you're probably happy to get 80% of what you projected, but at the end of the day, it's still a great outcome and good story to tell.
Great, that's really helpful. Could both of you speak to whether you used environmental insurance in your projects? Is that a tool that you guys use?
This is Chad at North Point. We do. Obviously, we do it for. Again, we plan on owning these things for 10 to 30 years, and hopefully we're clipping coupons every month as the rent checks come in. But, you know, there's a couple things. So sometimes we'll buy sites similar like the Perth Amboy once the horizontal is done, because really we just need land for our inventory to build and leased buildings. And so we'll buy it, but by the time that, you know, a responsible group like you just heard from on the Perth Amboy site, you have an NFA or something similar to where you really actually don't even need it. But we will put a PLL policy on, because by that time, when the cleanup's generally done, the policies are really cheap. So you can get a $15 million policy for $300,000. It goes 10 years, covers knowns, unknowns, on-sites, off-sites. But the real reason, or in a lot of cases, the main reason we do it is for marketing purposes. And so, like our site in Denver, where Home Depot was entering into a long-term lease, they said, you know, we know we're not in a chain of title, but we're still a name brand that if some dirtbag attorney comes along and wants to sue them, they're going to sue everybody, and they know Home Depot can afford it. So put a policy on it and add us as a named insured, and then we'll go ahead and enter into the lease with you. So for the most part, it's really putting a policy in place just so these corporate occupiers and, you know, the guys back in headquarters can say, yeah, we have insurance in place, so that if there ever is some dirtbag attorney that shows up wanting to sue everybody, we at least have a, you know, $15 million shock absorber and a PLL policy, and then we as North Point will usually guarantee the deductible risk.
We also put a PLL policy in place on this, and we always do, but it's only for the unknowns, and it's, again, it, the investors like to see it, the sellers like to see it, the future tenants or buyers and developers want to see it, but, you know, the goal is to never use it. It's nice to have it there, but it never will, you know, there's no such thing as cost cap insurance anymore, so it'll never pay for any of the real costs you absorb on things that, you know, everyone thought were there or could be worse than you thought were there, just for the unknowns. But it's a nice belt and suspenders to have, and we always do it as well.
Thanks. And just for our audience, PLL stands for, what does it stand for?
Pollution Liability Insurance.
Great. Thank you. Excellent. Okay, so a few more questions. Let's see. So to Chad about your North Point project. So you mentioned just a few minutes ago that you charge a 3.5% to 5% fee. Who are you charging that fee to?
Yeah, the downside is no one actually pays that. So what we do is, you know, well, just for simple math, say that there's $20 million worth of land to buy and $80 million worth of a building. So you have a total development cost, you know, the whole basket of goods is $100 million. And then for basically identifying them, putting the whole deal together, you know, finding a tenant, putting a lease on it, we'll charge a 3 to 5%. So say $100 million, we charge a 3% fee. So the total project cost is 3%. Well, again, we don't sell it. And so what we'll do is if we'll put some of our own cash into the deal, plus we'll basically impute that fee into the deal, which is a way to basically get the equivalent of putting more cash into a project so that we own more of the economics. So when the rent checks come in, we get a larger percentage of the rent, the net rent. But in the event that we would ever refinance it or sell it to somebody, that fee would be paid in the event of a sale or a refinance, so that, you know, we would get a larger percentage of it because we've imputed that fee. If an end user like a General Motors comes along and says, hey, build us a plant, go find the site, entitle it, get it permitted, build it, and then flip us the keys when you're done. In that case, when we were complete and GM were to write us a check for it, we would get paid that cash fee either along the way through the development process or in a lump sum at the end of the process for completing it. But typically we'll put that fee at risk. But in a long-term ownership thing, it's a little different animal because there's really no one there to pay you that fee. And a lot of our investors require us to leave our fee in so that we're not dragging checks out, because, you know, it keeps everybody's interest aligned and make sure we have some skin in the game. So,
great.
Did that answer the question, hopefully?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. So question for Catalyst, Steve. So how does a public amenity package come about? And this is kind of a larger question that maybe Chad could address to afterwards about, like, how often are community benefits part of a project?
So our redevelopment agreement was negotiated through the Perth Amboy Redevelopment Agency. They had a specific redevelopment agency. Okay. Our meetings took, I think, our redevelopment agreement, it took over almost 2 years to get to, and is about 80 pages, not including exhibits. Typical redevelopment agreements in New Jersey, including the boilerplate stuff that's legally required, are 15 to 20 pages, maybe 25. This one was extensive. And it was during all those meetings and negotiations, and we literally had meetings for a while every 3 weeks. They kept bringing up more things that they wanted. And it was a way the town had, you know, seen a redevelopment project recently that had started a few years earlier, much to, you know, their credit. And they hadn't really, they got $400,000 for a sewer line that had to be updated and expanded. So they wanted to then get more public amenities, and we were the last really big project in Perth Amboy. And they came up with wish lists and created wish lists, and they kept expanding those wish lists. And they met with their own council members and mayor, that it kept growing, and the cost kept growing. But thankfully, the project could sustain it. It's probably one of the only ones that actually could. We certainly didn't have that anywhere else we've done things, you know, but it was their own wish list between the council, the mayor, and speaking with their own population and what the city needed.
And the redevelopment agency required it. Like, that was something that...
Yeah, basically. If we wanted to get all the zoning changed, or the redevelopment plan changed, I mean, it was already an industrial site, but we needed to change parking ratios, to, you know, because it was a 20-year-old zoning plan that they had that has changed, the world has changed. We needed to basically give in on those things.
Sure.
And then, at the end, when we did put our feet down at some point and say we can't do anything more, but at that point it was already up to about $6.4 million.
So, great. Generally speaking, in your experience, for you and for Chad, how often are community benefit agreements or just community benefits overall part of a project?
100% of the time.
Yeah.
Can you say that again?
100% is what Chad said, and I agree with that.
Yeah. Everybody wants a bite of the apple. You know, you're the rich uncle that shows up, and all of a sudden everybody's got a direct genetic link to you. But, no, you know, the East Coast is worse. We do a lot, in, you know, from California through the Midwest, too. And, you know, we've certainly seen community benefit, you know, wish lists in excess of $10 million, just like the Catalyst guys kind of experienced. But, you know, in the Midwest, a lot of towns where they've had a GM plant or an auto plant closed down, you know, they're just happy to see you. And at some point, they'll say stuff like, hey, we don't have the cash to buy a new fire truck, or we need $50,000 for a new computer lab in the local school. If you guys push that up, we'll waive all your permit fees. We don't have the cash to come out of pocket, but we could absolutely help you guys save some money. And by the way, the council members are happy you're here, and they'll make sure that you get your planning and zoning, your city council voting, your permits all on the same night. Get up here and get going. And that's awesome. I mean, and typically it takes a small town in Pennsylvania or somewhere in Ohio that has lost jobs that want to see redevelopment happen. The East and West Coast, they feel a little bit more entitled to stuff, I would say. But, you know, we see it all over the board. But even if they're not asking for it, it sure as hell doesn't hurt to, you know, make a donation to the, you know, some local charities, or help the fire department or the police department out with, you know, buying canine units, things like that. Small dollars go a long way, especially politically, when they can take a 6-month permit process and crunch it down into 5 weeks for you.
Got it. And do you budget for these things up front?
Some of these things, just to emphasize, are only possible, like Perth Amboy is only possible in that marketplace. You know, 45 minutes south in New Jersey in Florence, where we did the Griffin Pipe Foundry redevelopment. I think our public amenity package of rails to trails, taking out some rail lines and creating that and dedicating land for ball fields to the town, I think that was more in the $500,000 range. So that's only 45 minutes south. Perth Amboy was unique in that sense that it was a really big property and a very hot market, and 45 minutes away, you could never have done that large an amenity package.
Wow. great. So do you budget for community amenities like this up front? Is that just part of your kind of overall budgeting process, given that you expect you're going to have to, you know, do something there?
Yeah, always
leave it is for items. Us. We try to flush it out up front, obviously.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. So I just want to be mindful of time. It's already 3 o'clock here on the East Coast, a couple minutes past, actually. So for those, we have a few more questions. Can our speakers stay on for a little bit?
Ma'am.
Just to chat for a few more minutes?
Sure.
Okay.
Yep.
Great. So for those of you who have to go, I appreciate you joining us. I'm just going to try to get to this last part of the conversation. That we got a few questions come in kind of about like for-profit. So one of the questions that came in about for-profit developers is, you know, you're likely to have some proprietary information in your calculations and, you know, for reasons like you wouldn't necessarily share them. Share those calculations. So do you have any ideas or thoughts on how communities can work with, you know, developers when, you know, there is this proprietary information the community doesn't necessarily have the full picture? What thoughts do you have about that? Maybe a place to start is, like, what is the type, general type of proprietary information that you might not want to share with the community?
This is Chad at North Point. For us, the biggest thing is, for the most part, it's an open book. And you got to be honest with people, like, hey, this is what we can afford to spend. If we can do it for that amount, we'll move forward. If we can't, we can't. And there's a lot of ways to make it happen. You know, you can eliminate impact fees or permit fees or help us reduce taxes, which helps attract tenants. So there's not a whole lot you can't discuss. For us, probably the most secretive or, you know, at least thing we have to keep opaque is that if we're working on behalf of an Adidas or an Amazon or somewhere where they don't want the community to know that they're looking because it could have job impacts elsewhere, we show up and we have to act on behalf of our tenants or our clients, and that has to be kept secret because there's impacts outside of just saying, hey, there's a great new project from Adidas coming. You know, the downside of that is, well, Adidas is coming here, but they're also going to vacate another building in another town, and they don't want to lose their labor force, you know, in that process or if that word gets out. So really for us, it's trying to protect our tenants and clients that want to maintain some confidentiality. And there's a lot of ripple effects with an announcement like that. So that's the biggest thing from our perspective.
And I would agree with Chad that same thing. It's, you know, the cost of buying the land, everyone's aware of it. It's a public record. Remediation funding sources are public records. Entitlement cost, anyone can guess. I mean, it's, you know, not that part's not rocket science. And they can estimate with their own engineers. So none of that. It came down to, in this deal, at the end, we had a contract to sell to a buyer, to a vertical developer. That was confidential in the beginning until they were past their own due diligence period. And then when Home Depot became the opportunity for them to have the build-a-suit, we had already done a fully engineered site plan and redevelopment agreement, and we had to go back the last couple months confidentially to meet with the mayor and to meet with council members and the township, and very quietly to amend that plan to make it so you could do a little more outdoor space. Very minor modifications, but things that needed to be done. And Home Depot was very wary of, you know, having their name out there. And they were looking at another site, and it had to be done fast because our buyer was competing with another site for Home Depot. So that was the confidential part.
Got it. Really helpful. Thank you. So two more questions, and then we'll let everybody go. So one comment that came in was about this is very helpful for-profit development. But if I worked with the grassroots organization, they wouldn't have the capacity to develop brownfields, as you guys talked about today. So do you have any thoughts or advice on who grassroots organizations should connect with in terms of the development community to collaborate on projects like this? Where should they start?
Well, Amy, if you want, I'll take that one, unless these guys got an idea. Go ahead, Chad.
Well, you know, we when we did, you know, when a tenant or a client or even just our own data says, hey, go to this part of Cleveland, I mean, we'll talk to local brokers. But really, you probably get the most unbiased or fair and balanced answer from a local EDC person, because either she or he will, you know, say, hey, these are all the sites that are available, but by the way, this is our problem child, that if you could help us redevelop it, you know, there's some incentives and there's some cost savings available. You know, that's one thing. You know, there's also communities that do say, hey, we're willing to give the land away for free if someone will bring the capital to get these things cleaned up and into redevelopment. You know, so you can reach out to developers like Catalyst or ourselves on the vertical side, and you know, that doesn't take a whole lot of money. You just got to know what the community wants and then put the message out there, because, you know, a lot of communities also get tripped up saying, hey, we got this site, and it's in, you know, a suburb of Detroit. It's kind of not the greatest area, and somehow they think that if they hold out long enough, they're going to get the next Apple headquarters, you know, or Google headquarters, when the reality is they need to be comfortable with who they are and say, hey, no, we'd be happy with an Amazon warehouse and a couple manufacturers here and put our people back to work. So I'd say if there's anything, yeah, the grassroots groups ought to just be comfortable with what they may end up with. And industrial is not a bad thing. I mean, it doesn't sound sexy, but comes with a lot of jobs, a lot of investment, and a lot of taxes that get paid. And then, you know, just make sure the local economic development communities are aware of what's out there and what the real use need should be. That's about all the thoughts I have on it.
Great. Thank you. Okay, and then the last question that we'll address today might be one for back to Vita Nova. So, how does the approach for risk at brownfield sites differ depending on whether you're working with private developers who may be willing to assume an equity stake in the profitability of the project long term versus a public developer?
It actually gets done with private guys like us and Catalyst.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Chad. You want to say some more?
That was it. I mean, okay. You know, developers are kind of seen as the evil capitalists, but, you know, I have 200 employees that make a great living because they're working, so we have to make a profit to pay everybody. But, you know, like the Catalyst guy said, the day you buy that thing, your cost starts going up because your interest clock or your return clock to your investors is ticking. So, you know, we're big fans of taking a public project and putting it into the private hands, because when you know, you're hemorrhaging $100,000 a month and, you know, preferred return or interest to your equity guys, turns out you take that treadmill and somehow find a way to turn it from a 10 up to an 11 and you run pretty fast. Whereas, you know, public entities are great and we need them, but they typically don't have the time horizon, you know, the compressed time horizon that the private developers do. Plus, they're regulated by more, you know, rules basically. And so if the private guys can show up and get creative and get the money immediately instead of waiting for a capital, you know, capital expenditure approval or a bond to be issued that could take 1 to 2 years, you know, private guys, we can raise $100 million in 3 months and get rolling. And so that's why we're, you know, maybe a little bit biased, but big proponents of turning it over to a public-private partnership or private, because the money can get raised immediately, the work can start immediately, and there's a lot of flexibility on the private side that the public entities, you know, just are constrained by.
Yeah, and, you know, when to follow up on what Chad said, when we take on, say, the Gerdau project was a 3-year project, but it was a year before that of due diligence trying to do that, trying to get the project. It's a 4-year commitment of our life that we live and we are pushing on a daily basis. And going crazy, you know, and at the end to try and get this done and get it closed out, get our permits, you know, having a delay on our waterfront development permit where we're waiting for one last group to sign off at a DEP cost you the month of August and the month of September. when you could be placing fill in really nice weather time, warm weather, to place that fill and put it in place makes a huge difference. And so you're constantly living it and constantly pushing it at all times. And, you know, maybe that might be the difference, because you know that everything, your entire life, your 4 years of, you know, your future, your past, is all based on finishing this and getting it done.
Yeah. And so, Amy, what I would say is, you know, certain markets are going to need to start with a public entity, and then, but ultimately the point of a public entity getting involved is to be able to attract the market. So, you know, you take the Toledo Jeep plant, you know, no private developers were going to do all that, do the access, et cetera. So the Port Authority came in, set it up, but the point was so they could get it to the point that folks like these guys could come in and help them get it across the line and get jobs onto the site. So it's just a matter of evaluating upfront what's possible and being realistic about it. And what's great about a public entity is sometimes on a risky side, a developer will take it on, but they really can't get it done, and then it's stuck. And so nothing happens, whereas a public entity can get it to a certain point and then attract the private guys to come in and take it the rest of the way.
That's excellent, and I think we're going to end there because that perspective from our developers and Mike, you summing it up, I think is a really good place to end, and I really appreciate you all sharing the perspective of kind of how that works as private developers. I think that's really important for all of us to understand.
Thanks for having us on today.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Who knew that we could go over a two-hour webinar but on a Friday, but we did it. Thanks to everyone who stayed on. I'm so grateful to our speakers from Catalyst, from North Point, and from Vita Nova. One last plug here for our workshop at the conference. We really do hope that you can come, because you'll have a chance to try all this material out and see it through the lens of a contaminated site. So it's a really great learning opportunity. So again, thank you for this. Abe's going to walk us through a few closing steps. But with this, we're going to wrap up this webinar series. And I really invite your feedback and let us know what you're interested in this topic area. And we'll see what we can pull together for the future. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Amy. And I'd just like to give a couple quick reminders that the webinar slides and other materials from today are available on the seminar homepage, which is what you use to log in and join us today. And on that homepage, too, there's also a feedback form. Please fill it out and let us know what you thought of today's session. The feedback is extremely valuable to us. And also, if you'd like to get a certificate for participation in today's session, you can get that once you fill out the form. And lastly, today's session was recorded, and it'll be available for viewing in about a week, and everybody will receive an email notifying you when that recording is available. Thank you again for joining us, and we hope to see you next month at the workshop and at the Brownfields Conference in Los Angeles. And with that, I will formally conclude today's session and wish you all a good weekend. Take care.
Thank you.